and the lion becomes man. And cursed is the man whom the lion eats, and the lion becomes man. Does anybody want to parse that for us? Just a little bit here at the beginning. And Stephen, not you, because you already done it.
And he told me.
Okay, that's two out right there. I'd like somebody to stand and talk to us just for a minute, maybe, about what you think that cryptic comment in the Gospel of Thomas is trying to say. In the back, please do that.
So I was talking about it at breakfast this morning, and I thought I was talking about it at breakfast this morning, and I thought maybe the lion is symbolic of the shadow side, and if you eat the shadow side, that's owning the shadow, and you can make the shadow blessed in some way. The shadow can serve some kind of good purpose, some wholeness purpose, rather than some other purpose. Whereas if the shadow eats you and takes over your life because you're not owning it or working with it, then that will be a kind of curse on you. Then you'll be lost to the shadow. In either way, in either case, there's going to be some sort of unity of the person and the shadow. But it can be one that where you incorporate the shadow or the shadow incorporates you.
Why is the lion blessed in this act?
Because the shadow isn't necessarily evil. Shadow could be, but if the person owns the shadow, the person owns it and takes it on and works with it and finds a way to integrate, then it can serve the good.
Okay, thanks. That's a good start. Does anybody have anything you want to add? I'm glad you, by the way, I'm glad that you reminded us that shadow is an archetype. Therefore, it contains shadow that's positive and shadow that's negative. Both. Right. Very good.
Yeah. Well, this reminds me of Life of Pi, and so I tend to think of the lion as animal instinct.
That's good. That's a good addition. Go expand on that a little bit.
Well, if we're here to incarnate, we're here to be more than spirit. We're here to also live the human life, which involves animal instincts. I'm just wondering here. But if you're able to ingest them, you become more powerful. But if they're blessed, if you're taken over by them unconsciously, then they live you. Then they take over your humanity.
Okay, that's
good.
And you
lose it or something.
Yeah, that's quite condensed.
Nice
and quite
wonder in the woods.
Yeah, quite full of meaning what you said. We could ask, why is the lion chosen in this metaphor and not, for example, the tiger is one, but I want to get a more dramatic difference, the rhinoceros.
Giraffe.
Well, the lion is the king of beasts, right? He represents the apex of that family, that genus of life. Time for one more word.
I just have a simpler attitude that you bless what you eat for giving its life so you could have sustenance. So the lion is blessed because he gave up his life so the man could eat him. I have more trouble with the other half.
Okay, we'll do the other half. Just briefly to recap. You have some good ideas, and if you played with those, you probably would drain this beautiful saying of its deep, deep meaning, I think. Interesting that it speaks of eating. I have found that the human alimentary canal from one end to the other is a perfect theater of the psyche. So many things happen in the alimentary canal that lend themselves to metaphorizing psychic life. I won't go through the whole thing, mercifully. But the process of eating something is pretty dramatic, actually. First, of course, you have to get in its vicinity and take it in. And once it's there, you have to change its nature into smaller particles with the grinders. And then you have to get it down the canal into the stomach. And what happens to the food in the stomach? It's taken apart into its constituents, into its building blocks, its amino acids and so on. It's taken apart there. When it came in, it had a very distinctive nature, which is lion. We might think of that as the archetypal instincts that this friend has mentioned already. Instinctive energy, a level of energy which is potentially noble but dangerous if not properly handled. It comes into that place of digestion and is disassembled into its constituent parts. And then it goes on into the other parts of the system. And what happens there? Those parts are reassembled as you or me, according to the laws of your nature. Interesting, that? It comes in behaving according to the laws of the lion. And if I can eat it and digest it and take it apart, disassemble it, and then reassemble it into human constituency, it becomes myself. This is the way that what is unconscious and instinctual and archetypal comes into human life as behavior, relationship, and all of that. Why didn't the speaker just say that? Why not say it up front so we don't have to work and take 5 minutes of our afternoon? Anybody quickly, why not say it? What do you think, Lorraine?
Because the soul works with image and metaphor rather than logic. And you, just by turning this around in our psyches, it becomes a deeper part of who we are rather than our little brain figuring it all out. And I have to say that, like, I couldn't figure it out, and now I feel like, oh, okay.
Well, that's it's a good way to confront this material, to say, I can't figure it out, but that's okay. And if I live with it a little while, it will start to, out of the shadows comes some form. But I love the idea of taking apart things and reassembling them according to the laws of our own being. This is the way you personalize archetypal lion energy. If it eats you, then the food will not be digested. In fact, you become lion. And what happens then? One becomes invaded by and taken over by the archetypal instinctual energies of life. And out of that, I think, arises most, if not all, of the violence in the world.
But why does the aphorism say that becomes man, even when the lion eats the man?
Because the idea is the lion is actually brought in and masticated and churned up. It's no longer a lion as such. But it cannot be reassembled according to any peaceful, loving laws of your nature. But it can be assembled according to shadowy laws. That garbled that a little bit. But I think in both cases, the food is taken in, but its fate is different. When the lion eats the man, this is not the destiny of the food to consume the eater. So something is reversed. It's as if it's a picture of energies falling out of a manageable, humane level and falling into instinctual levels. I think of the ways that people get caught up in mobs or in mob action and lose individual discretion and empathy with others. Well, that's probably enough of that. But it's not enough, I know. It's never enough. But one last word over here.
I just wonder about the original Greek, maybe. Was Gospel of Thomas in Greek?
Well, Greek was not original here. Coptic is the original language. Yeah. I've got it here, but I can't translate it for you.
So does the word becomes in that language have more of a two-way street to it? Does it become a little bit more like becomes integrated with?
It's an important question, and it reminds us that we really should study documents and literature in the original language. and be conversant in that ourselves to get full meaning. Yeah, it's a good point.
That's what I think his question was covered
from. Yeah, okay. Well, the Gospel of Thomas is full of those kinds of statements. And as to why the writer didn't come right out and say it, he did, according to his lights. He said it in ways that he knew that his contemporaries would understand. And they did. They got it. Many of them did. But it's a case. It's another case of a piece of writing that comes into being no later than probably the year 110 AD. So at that time, people were talking in imagery much more than we do now. Okay. Thank you for that. It's good to wrestle with those things. Two brief leftovers from yesterday afternoon. I couldn't remember the names of two people I talked to you about. One of them was a man, contemporary of ours, who worked with dolphin and large whale intelligences. He did a number of other things. He created the isolation tank. Yeah, back there. That was not the person. The person was Dr. John Lilly, Lilly. He was a physician, he was a neuroscientist, he was a psychoanalyst, and much of the rest of what he was is less reputable. He's a very interesting guy. I spent two or three weekends with his group in New York learning a little bit about what he knew about dolphins, and it was fascinating. He also experimented with drugs a lot, particularly the currently popular drug ketamine. The other person that I mentioned and failed to know her name is Hypatia, Hypatia. She was the daughter of a famous mathematician in Alexandria, and contrary to what I said yesterday about her calendar, she lived in about the 4th century of the Common Era. So she's way out there, just about the time of the, a little past the time of the Council of Nicaea. She was a philosopher. She was the head, a brilliant person by all report, head of the Platonist school in Alexandria, philosopher and teacher. In about the year 415, after there had been a great deal of trouble stirred up in Alexandria, rivalries between the Christian bishop and the local head of the city and the mobs associated with each. One day, Hypatia was simply walking in the streets of Alexandria, and she was surrounded by a mob. She was stripped naked in the streets and taken and slashed to death with probably broken oyster shells. And then she was dismembered, and all her limbs were burned. That's the way the lion ate people in Alexandria in the fifth Christian century. Hypatia, a very.
Why was she subjected to this treatment?
Because people thought of her as she had been condemned by the Christian bishop as taking part in sorcery. She was a gifted person. She was a mathematician of some note, an astronomer. There was in Alexandria at this time a very spectacular culture and civilization. There is a book with that title, Alexandria, and I would highly recommend you to read it if you want to get a little more information about that time. But today what I want to do together is to look at what happens at the interface between two modes of being for an individual. When one stands in a place of betweenness, between what was and what needs to be, what might be, what's coming, there's an interface. What happens there? Examples include, of course, the boundary between childhood and adolescence, and between later and younger adulthood. It also includes states possible to the elder person all the way through their physical life, I think. There are different ways of experiencing, sharing with others, and speaking about these zones of a profound change in a life. It is, I think, in a very direct way, a discourse about learning how to die and about being reborn. Learning how to die. Not as a philosophical or intellectual proposition, but as a real event in psychic life. Mircea Eliade, whom I mentioned yesterday, and you may not know him, some of you, Mircea is M-I-R-C-E-A, and Eliade is E-L-I-A-D-E. It's from the front, M-I-R-C-E-A-E-L-I-A-D-E. He's written an elegant small book entitled Rites and Symbols of Initiation, The Mysteries of Birth and Rebirth, in which he explores the sociology and the psychology of initiatory rituals of passage in various human settings. And that's going to give us some really important clues. Here's what Eliade has to say. And these are his words. The majority of initiatory ordeals more or less clearly imply a ritual death followed by resurrection or a new birth. The central moment of every initiation is represented by the ceremony symbolizing the death of the novice and his or her return to the fellowship of the living. But they return to life a new person, assuming another mode of being. Sounds dramatic, and it is. And it requires drama. It requires theater. It requires ritual. Now, just noting the way that images of ritual death are powerful elements of initiation, Eliade goes on this way. We must note this characteristic of the archaic mentality. The belief that a state cannot be changed without first being annihilated. That is, without a child dying to childhood, for example. In order to be created anew, the old world must first be annihilated. I told you yesterday about the two children, one of whom dreamed of meteors coming out of the sky, and the other that feared death at the hands of this pursuing animal of some kind. The question that comes from this kind of notion or even literature is this. What is it in the 11 or 12-year-old child?